You might have been listening at the top of the show. I was talking about President Barack Obama's address to the Democratic National Convention, where he conspicuously, to some people, I bet a lot of people missed it, but he conspicuously did not mention nuclear energy. David, I guess I will start with that question. Was that actually a step forward as far as you're concerned?
Well, first, I want to say thanks for having me on this morning.
Oh, it's my pleasure. My pleasure to have you.
First timer here.
I think I had you on the phone once.
Right.
Never had you in the studio. How do you like our digs here?
I'm impressed.
Yeah, it's pretty nice stuff. Denny, you know, he put this, cobbled this all together this morning before we got on the air.
Cleaned it up, swept up everything.
Yeah, exactly.
Hope you like it.
Much appreciated. Yeah. So back to your question. Yes, it is kind of noticeable in its omission, because the last several States of the Union addresses that the president did, he's explicitly mentioned nuclear. So to have this drop out, people are interpreting it a lot of different ways. But honestly, the reality is that nuclear is pretty much over when you really look at it from a realistic standpoint. The so-called nuclear renaissance, which began in Chicago at a conference at the Palmer House in December in 2001, went absolutely nowhere. We're 11 years into it, and we've built zero nuclear reactors in the United States. In the meantime, we had events like Fukushima and other events in Japan and others around the world. If we were a rational species, this game would be over. It should have been over a long time ago. So I think the president is just kind of cutting losses. You know, he's recognizing we're heading in a different direction and, you know, acknowledging that in the past, a lot of his campaign contributions came from Exelon and individuals within the Exelon Corporation. I think they know each other well enough that to understand that some of this is what you have to do in public, and the proof will be in the pudding if he gets elected over the next 4 years.
Well, he was up until Fukushima, however you pronounce that, still pushing for plants to be built in America. Has he backed off totally on that? Are you seeing anything?
We haven't seen anything public in that regards. We were very disappointed in the last year and a half about our government's response to the disaster itself. And by the way, I'm very careful these days not to call Fukushima an accident. We'll get into the reasons for that later. It's a disaster. Accidents are things are, you know, like, oopsie, I didn't see it coming. Mm-hmm. They saw it coming. They knew this could happen. TEPCO decided to go on the cheap, and they paid the price because, you know, they spun the wheel and it came up 13 black. But in this country, we had expected at least that this would be a wake-up call, much as we saw after the Chernobyl disaster in 1986. And it's actually been just the opposite. We've had the regulators, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, putting off the implementation of safety improvements at United States reactors. We actually had, I'm surprised the tabloids didn't pick up on this one. Late last year, we actually had a public execution of the chairman of the NRC in terms of character assassination by his four colleagues on the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. They trashed the guy in public for personnel reasons, which led a whole bunch of conservative senators to get on their high horn demanding his resignation, because this was the only guy on the five-person commission saying, we got to move fast. We have to look into what's wrong or what is potentially wrong with U.S. reactors and correct them quickly. He was the only one who was saying that. And for that, the industry went after him. They trashed him in public. They said he was belittling his female staff, which was kind of interesting. Never proven, you know, never any evidence provided. Yet this guy had to endure all this abuse for months, and finally he resigned this past July.
And you're saying they did this simply because he was being rational?
I would say that's the reason, yes.
Well, that's not surprising. That's not the first time that that's happened.
So to bring it back to the president, though, you know, he's the head honcho, and he presided over this tableau, so to speak, and really didn't go to bat for nuclear safety the way we had hoped that he would. So the jury's still out. You know, many of us feel that there isn't a whole lot of difference between some Republicans and some Democrats, certainly not on the nuclear issue. And we still have a long way to go before we move towards a sane energy policy. And it just hasn't been coming in terms of overt leadership from the top.
Well, going back to last year and the Fukushima tragedy, as you call it, before that, it seems to me that you must have felt a little lonely at the National Energy Information Service, because there wasn't a whole lot of attention being paid to nuclear. It was as if, yeah, it's just among the clean energy options that we have. It's just as good as solar. It's just as good as wind. Oh, of course, we've got nuclear and we've got all these plants. So let's just put that into the strategy. And you must have felt like you were crying out in the wilderness.
Well, our organization has been around 31 years. So you grow a little crust over that period of time where you don't let it affect you. It's certainly out there. Oh, and by the way, we're the Nuclear Energy Information Service.
What did I say? Oh, nuclear.
I don't want to take... responsibility for a whole country.
You know, sometimes I work so fast that I type these things, and that's my problem. I apologize.
No problem.
Nuclear Energy Information Service, sometimes known as NEIS.
That's correct. But as I say, you know, we are used to this sort of being the flea on the tail of the environmental dog, which gets ignored. For a long, long time, because even amongst some of our colleagues, there are some so-called environmentalists who still feel that nuclear has a role to play. We do not. We think the numbers have shown that for decades. And again, if we really analyzed it by the facts, this would be an industry that would have been long gone. What you really have here is an absolutely miraculous public relations phenomenon going on with nuclear power, where on the one hand, you have this abstraction that you just described, clean and green and kids playing around the nuclear plants and all this nonsense that we've seen in advertising. And then you have the reality, which blew up in our faces literally on March 11th last year. So all we can do is just keep going at it. I think Schopenhauer said that truth goes through three phases. You know, first, it's ridiculed, which we have been ridiculed for 31 years as being no nukes kooks. Then it's violently opposed, which also has happened, as we see, where you can actually lynch a chairman of a federal regulatory agency in public and get away with it. And then finally, truth is embraced as self-evident. And I think we're at phase 2.5 at this point, where it's just so ridiculously expensive that the magic that has to be worked for people to swallow it is just beyond the pale anymore.
That is David Kraft with the Nuclear Energy Information Service. It seems to me that in the area alone where we have to deal with the waste, that right out of the gate, it shows how unsustainable nuclear energy is. We have, in the whole time that we have had nuclear power plants in America and in pretty much the world, haven't figured out what to do with that, and we're still debating it, and we try to bury it under mountains, and some people say, let's shoot it into space, and, you know, and other crazy stuff. We still haven't dealt with the number one issue or the basic issue of nuclear power, have we?
Absolutely. That's the perfect thing to start with, actually, is the waste. From our opinion, of course, all of nuclear power is waste, but in particular, the detritus that comes out of the plants, which is essentially the spent fuel rods, which no longer are functional to produce heat and steam properly. And then you have a copious amount of what they call low-level waste, millions and millions of cubic feet of this stuff that has to be disposed of. None of it has really been environmentally responsibly disposed of since the beginning of the nuclear age. I don't know if people know this, but the Manhattan Project waste from the 1940s is buried in a Cook County Forest Preserve southwest of Chicago called Red Gate Woods. So that's just one example.
There was a big wow there from Sarah and from me. Okay, I think I knew this, but I had forgotten this.
That's the point. It's easily forgotten because, you know, file and forget, and you bury it, and then you put a little marker there and plant trees and stuff, and nobody sees it. Well, we're going to be going back out there in December because December 2nd is the 70th anniversary of the first chain reaction, which took place at University of Chicago, and we are organizing a national conference here in the area to commemorate that event, hopefully on the University of Chicago campus. So we'll have more details on that. But back to the waste itself. This is the only industry that I am aware of, not just in the United States, but perhaps even in the world, that did not have to demonstrate before it was implemented that it had a cradle-to-grave method of dealing with its wastes. I'm a Chicago guy. I born and raised here, grew up here. I don't know where you're from, Mike, but...
Detroit.
Well, close enough.
Yeah. Really, it's stone's throw.
When I was a punk kid, you know, hanging out at Oak Street Beach in the 60s, two things were going on around here. One was all these nuclear plants in Illinois, which we have 14 reactors, by the way.
Yeah, and we're going to get to that in a second. Us being a hot spot, literally and figuratively.
A lot of them were being built in the 60s. But the other thing that was happening was the John Hancock building was going up at the same time. So I got to watch this thing go from ground up. And it occurred to me many, many decades later when I was looking at the Hancock again and, you know, bemoaning this nuclear tragedy that's gone on far too long. What if they would have built the John Hancock building with no bathrooms, with the knowledge that they had to tear it down in 40 years and move it someplace and dispose of it? What would it have looked like? Would they have built it at all? You know, silly question, but again, the juxtaposition of what was going on at the time shows the difference in mentality here. One is, you know, you're a responsible designer and engineer and you build the building the best you can. The other is, we'll kick the can down the road and hope somebody else takes care of it later. And that's essentially what's happened with nuclear waste. We do not have an effective, environmentally responsible disposal program in place. And the industry wants to continue 20 years at each plant, producing more of it with still no rescue on the horizon for what we're going to do with this waste.
Don't worry, we'll get to it. We're working on it.
Trust
really.
Trust us.
Yeah, trust. Oh,
trust us.
Yeah, really. You know, like the Republican platform. Just trust us. Everything's going to be fine.
The trust us thing actually blew up a couple of months ago in one of the courts, a federal court. For years, the federal regulators, again, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, had promulgated this rule called the Waste Confidence Rule. And what this was the disposal of nuclear waste on paper, saying it's perfectly okay to keep generating nuclear waste, to keep operating reactors, to build new reactors, because we have every confidence that the waste will have a place to go to relatively soon. And this has been their rubber stamp approval for all of these license extensions that many reactors have received. They get a 20-year license extension. Normally, they would have operated 40 years and shut. Many reactors are now reaching that age, and they're getting a 20-year boost. So they get to go out 60, and now they're even talking an additional 20 beyond.
Well, because there's so much money invested in it already.
Right.
I mean, you think, oh, we can squeeze another 20 years, and guess what? After that, we'll squeeze another, and suddenly we're at 80 years.
Well, I don't know if you came here in your 1958 Ford Galaxy or not, but I don't know many people who do drive those anymore. And that's exactly what you're dealing with nuclear plants. Now, granted, there's a lot of repairs going on over the
years. But I like that. That's the tweet. Our nuclear power plants are like the 1958 Ford Galaxy. You know, if you're still driving that, congratulations, you've kept it going.
With
how much longer?
Whistles.
You're right. How much longer will it exist until it just totally collapses?
Well, I actually did meet a guy who drove his Mercedes over 2 million miles. He goes to the Illinois Renewable Energy Fair every year. But Ford Galaxies aren't Mercedes, and not all reactors are built equal either.
Yeah.
So this is the issue of the waste. It's kick the can down the road. And the courts finally said, NRC, you are not on the same planet. You will not be allowed to do this anymore. You will restudy your whole calculations and rationale for the so-called waste confidence rule. And just the other day, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was forced to actually pull the plug for 2 years on any further licensing. So reality is smacking these guys in the face finally. So the waste confidence rule, which was a sham for 20-some years, is finally at least on hold temporarily, but hopefully will be off the books for good.
That's David Kraft, director of the Nuclear Energy Information Service. We've got, you know, I haven't even given out the phone number and people are calling in. 773-763-9278. 773-763-9278. Do you mind taking a couple of phone calls here,
Fine
David?
By me. That's what we're here for.
Let's go to line one. Amtrak, Tim, I haven't heard from you in a long, long time. How are you, buddy?
Doing pretty good. I actually made Amtrak Select Plus status. That's 10,000 miles on Amtrak.
Whoa, let me give you a...
Congratulations.
And Sarah says hi, obviously. You guys, are you on Twitter, Amtrak Tim?
No, I don't do that stuff.
Oh, that's a shame because...
But I got to weigh in on this nuclear subject here.
Go for it.
And, I'm going to ask David here. Do you have any... what is your feeling on thorium, molten salt reactors? Do you guys have a stand on that?
We're doing a lot of research on it now because it's come up more and more as a so-called alternative to the current type reactors that we have, which don't use thorium. They use uranium, and some reactors are even starting to blend plutonium into the fuel. But the thorium advocates push the reactor as an alternative because Number one, they say that number one, thorium is much more available than the uranium. Yes, and the reactor itself, if and when it works, is actually a much more passive and safe type reactor.
Well, not yet. It worked in the 1950s for over 5 years. Mm-hmm. It's a proven technology.
So this gets back to the point of how our reactors got selected, why, and why are we going down certain paths and not others? And then the final question is, do we actually need to go down the nuclear path at all, which we'll get to in a minute?
Well, I think we do, and I didn't even answer your first question, though, about thorium.
So we're looking into it. We don't have a position on it yet. I guess what we would say, though, is this trip really necessary? Because the other kinds of alternatives we do have been shown and are showing right now in actual day-to-day operation to be just as effective as cranking out electrons as any nuclear power plant of any design.
Well, let me stop. I want to stop you there. All of the alternative energies you're describing all require rare earth elements. Rare earth elements are exclusively controlled by the Chinese. If we go to an alternative energy exclusive power grid and we do not answer the thorium rare earth problem, thorium is a contaminant found in all rare earth mining. We have gigantic stockpiles of this stuff. So do the Chinese. We've stopped rare earth mining in this country because of thorium contamination. The waste of the rare earth mines is basically free fuel. The Chinese know this, right? And if we go the alternative route and we don't take care of the thorium rare earth problem, we will exchange Saudi Arabia for China for our power energy. Does your group have any answer to the rare earth mining problem?
One is that, at least in the wind sector, I'm not as familiar with the solar.
Rare earth's required in wind.
Yes, I know that. That's why I'm bringing it up.
All right. You know what? You guys are having an insider conversation here. No. It's okay. I mean, I'm fascinated by this, but I want to know why or how, you know, the rare earths are involved in these other technologies, and I assume my listeners want to know that as well. Dave or Tim, who wants to handle?
Well, I was about to explain. With the wind turbines, there are certain mechanical features that require these metals to be used, and that is absolutely correct.
Where do they come from?
At the same time, the wind industry itself is aware of this vulnerability and is starting to look into alternatives. Now, some of the alternatives make some of the turbines less efficient than if you were to use the rare earths. What the caller's question begs is, if China is sitting on all these rare earths, then why aren't they choosing thorium reactors first instead of the other reactors, which they've claimed they want to build 100 of? India is in the same situation.
Let me answer your question.
Well, no, I didn't finish my answer.
Okay, one at a time. I'm going to let Dave talk now, and then Tim, I'm going to give you time to rebut.
Now, India's thorium reserves are even greater, yet they have had difficulty in generating a thorium reactor program as well, even though it's much more abundant there than even China or the United States. They also have opted for what we call these light water reactors. So this gets you into the question of why nuclear at all? Why do these nations even go down this route? And regrettably, when you scratch deep enough, it comes down to the issue of the ability to recover nuclear materials for a weapons program.
Okay, Tim?
Stop. Thorium has no weapon capability. That's proven in the 1950s. Have you read the papers from Seberg?
Yes, and if you read the current papers, you know that you can tweak a thorium reactor actually to produce the kinds of materials you need for nuclear weapons. You don't get it on the first go-round, but you can tweak the reactor enough to get the 235.
Okay, Tim, here's
233 is the output. What paper? I want your source.
Well, let's deal with that offline, and if you send me an email at neis.org, I'll be glad to get you the sources.
Dave, Tim. Okay.
The other one about the rare earths. I would like to talk now.
All right, go for it.
The rare earths are the reason all of the electronic industry is in China. China knows that rare earths are the ball bearings of the high-tech economy. Like we bombed the German high-tech, we bombed the German ball bearing factories during World War II because we knew they were involved in everything. The Chinese also know that rare earths are the ball bearings for this new high-tech economy. If we do not have some policy to deal with the rare earth elements and the thorium waste product. I mean, thorium is just free. It's just free waste coming off rare earth mines. Then we are going to have all the high tech go to China, all the energy go to China. The Chinese now, why are the Chinese pursuing this? Do you know the Chinese sent the premier, their premier of their academic of science, went to Oak Ridge, where they had our thorium reactor, and it basically started a dialogue with them because they want to extract from Oak Ridge all the technology for making molten salt thorium reactors. The guy has already been there. He is the son of the past premier of China. He's already going to Oak Ridge to find out about thorium reactors. If we don't get moving real fast, we're going to be so behind. We're going to have no way to make high tech equipment. Solar panels require rare earths as well. So we're going to have no way to get the high tech materials to make solar panels, wind, and then the Chinese are going to have carbon free, inexpensive power, and they're going to bury the West.
Okay, you've had your say, Tim. Now I'm going to let Dave rebut that, and then I'm going to let you go. But hang on for a second.
Well, I don't know if it's so much of a rebuttal. It's more the idea of, as I said, if the Chinese were so hot on this, why did they select the other kind of reactor first? And I think I've explained why that is. I totally agree that any bottleneck in any kind of a complex system, whether it's electronics or energy, and rare earths certainly are that, have to be addressed in an international forum. Whether we're going to be left freezing in the dark because we don't have thorium reactors, I think that's just not correct at all. We have and we will get to innovative ways which are going to decrease that dependency that was described, and we'll move to other sources like we have before.
Tim, my final question to you is, so are you, I take it you think we should be developing thorium reactors?
Absolutely, 100%.
And moving away from the reactors that we have now?
I would agree. I think Fukushima, two things I have to say. One, I think we're all on one level that we have to have a carbon-less energy system. I think we all could agree with that.
Agreed.
Now the question is, how do we get there? I think the light water reactor is a relic of the Cold War. We went to light water reactors because we wanted plutonium to make nuclear weapons. It's a relic of the Cold War. They should be phased out. If we do not go and find a way to get the rare earths to make some alternative energy possible, we're either going to import it from Chinese, or we're going to just burn coal, and burning coal is a disaster.
Well, we're agreeing on some things here, Tim, and as always, your contribution is very thoughtful, and I appreciate it. And great hearing from you. Thanks for calling. Have a great Sunday.
All right, you too.
Bye-bye. 773-763-9278 is our telephone number. I'm with David Kraft, who's the director of the Nuclear Energy Information Service. He makes some good points there. But I think the important point is that he's right. We've got to get away from the carbon-based. It's killing us right now, but we're stuck in going down a road that, as you said, happened, 50 years ago. Part of our problem that we're left with right now is what's happening in Illinois and in the area here, because Michigan's part of this, Illinois is part of it. We have a lot of nuclear reactors here, and I want to discuss that, which we will get to in just a second. It's the Mike Novak Show on Chicago's Progressive Talk. I'm happy to have in the studio with me David Kraft, who's the director of the Nuclear Energy Information Service, and I'm finally saying it right, which is a really good thing. Ugh. I hate it when I do those typos. You do it, you know, you're working real fast and you think you got it in your head. And here's the thing, you know, as we went into the commercial break there, I was talking about the care of trees and drought. Guess what? Drought affects nuclear power plants as well. And that is an issue that I was completely unaware of, just as I was unaware of the thorium issue. So I'm getting an education here today, and I hope a lot of people listening are as well. What happens when we go into an extended drought like we have had in much of the United States and we have a lot of nuclear power plants, Dave?
This is the second part of the response to your previous caller, as well as all nuclear reactors and all fossil fuel plants require a lot of water to do two things. First, to make the steam, which drives the turbines, which then creates electricity. But in the case of nuclear, in particular, they're very sensitive in needing water to keep the reactor itself cool enough and all the machinery and stuff cool enough so that you don't end up with a nuclear disaster on your hands. So there's two reasons for it with a nuke plant. And this idea of drought, I guess you could consider drought as sort of like global warming light. Because if we are heading into a climate disrupted world, and I'd say the preponderance of atmospheric scientists say that we are, Illinois is going to have the climate of West Texas perhaps by the middle of the century if we don't turn things, maybe it's even too late, turn things around quickly. Now, that means that moving forward, the rare earth issue as being the bottleneck for a power production is going to pale into insignificance to the availability of water, because you're going to have to make some hard choices in a West Texas climate here of do you use the 85% of Illinois surface water for power plant production every day, or do you use it for agriculture, municipal water supplies, drinking, and sanitation? To me, it's a no-brainer. So water is actually the driving commodity in a climate-disrupted world, not rare metals. Yeah. And since our power plant system right now is tied to the steam cycle, it's tied to the availability of water. We have already seen in 1988, in 2005, in 2006, that Illinois reactors had to be closed or curtailed in their operation when they were needed most because there were insufficient supplies of river water to both keep them cool and not melt down and to produce steam. And then finally, the last piece of the puzzle is all these power plants have to discharge hot water back into bodies of water, whether those are naturally occurring or man-made. And the EPA regulates how hot that water can get to and how hot it can become. So what we had happened in 1988 was because of the drought back then, Illinois lost over 100 reactor days of operation, either to actual total shutdown or curtailed operation, because the water they were dumping back into the environment was simply too hot and exceeding EPA water standards.
How hot was the water they're putting in, and how hot is it the water they're putting in now?
Comparable to what we saw this past summer here in Chicago, where the limits are supposed to be 90 degrees Fahrenheit, and in the case of this past summer, it was reaching 97, 98 degrees in some cases.
But there are people who say, that's only 7, 8 degrees.
Yeah.
Okay, here's a quote. There was an article in the Chicago Tribune on August 20th. So, you know, we're just talking several weeks ago about this issue. I found the thing that sort of was the thumb to my eye was a quote from Julia Wozniak of Midwest Generation. Here's her quote. Do you want people to start dying or do you want to save some fish? So she's got it sussed. She's got it boiled down to the real issue, which is we're doing this just because we want to save some darn fish.
In a sense, that's correct. But the fish just don't stay in the river. Sometimes people catch those fish and sometimes people eat those fish. You also get drinking water from many of the rivers and some of the communities around the Chicago area, at least. So it's more than simply do we want to kill fish or not, especially in the case of nuclear reactors, because you're not only dumping heat back into the environment, and that has to be diluted, but nuclear power plants are permitted by law to discharge radionuclides into the water if they're below regulatory standards, number one, or if there's an accident that's uncontrollable, number two.
That's something to look forward to.
So you can, and we do, discharge radioactive materials into our waterways. If you don't have sufficient water to either move it, in the case of the volume of water, or to dilute it properly, you're not going to dilute the heat. You're not going to dilute the radioactivity. It's going to concentrate locally. You will have fish kills for sure, which I would argue could be a health hazard. If anyone grew up in Chicago in the 60s and 70s, not many of us went to the beaches because of the alewives washing ashore and rotting.
Mm-hmm. I came in at the very – I moved to Chicago in 1978, and I came in at the tail end of that.
Yeah.
And it was – I was amazed. I thought, wow, this is this big, beautiful, clean lake. It wasn't so big, beautiful, and clean.
That's right. And in the case of the nuclear reactors, then, it's more than that because as the radioactive materials cluster and fall out closer and closer to the discharge pipes of the plants – that's going to be reconcentrated in the local biosystem, whether it's plants that'll take them up and then get eaten by fish or just, you know, directly by fish having to pass through radioactive water that's not being diluted properly. Some folks would argue it's a small amount, but it's 24/7, 365. You know, it goes on all the time. And that's what we're concerned about in a global warming world is this reconcentration. The final piece of that, though, is strangely enough, when you have higher and higher water temperatures, the efficiency of these reactors to actually produce power decreases. because of the physics involved in the thermodynamics. So in a global warming world or a climate-stressed world, these power plants are actually going to produce less electricity than they do now. And they'll be thermally polluting and radioactively polluting the waterways. So we can avoid all of this by moving to a different source of energy. And what we're urging is that now is the time to plan to get off of the steam cycle completely. And steam cycle means fossil fuels and nuclear. So I agree with your former caller that we do have to go carbon free and nuclear free. And we can do it because there have been numerous, numerous books, studies, which give roadmaps as to how we can start weaning ourselves off of not just the fossil cycle and the nuclear cycle, but the steam cycle as well.
That is Dave Kraft from the Nuclear Energy Information Service. Let's take another call. Let's go to San Francisco. Dave, you're on the Mike Novak Show. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, and greetings from Abalone Alliance Safe Energy Clearinghouse.
Greetings so, back.
Yeah, yeah. You hear me all right?
Yeah, I can hear you fine.
Great. Yeah, I wanted to raise a couple of different things. With Fukushima, it's been recognized that many of the employees, the emergency workers, are being overexposed. And what's interesting is the management and the leadership, the team leaders, are also getting overexposed. So if you look at someone who went to college to work as a nuclear technician, and then their work life gets all of a sudden cut short because of an emergency, the potential for having institutional memory, a long-term employee is going to know all the ins and outs of a plant, but if all of a sudden they get exposed to such a degree that they can never return to that plant, then all of a sudden that plant becomes somewhat rudderless because it doesn't have any long-term employees. People are getting overworked, overexposed, and so in the course of 6 months, you might have a completely new team that has no experience with that plant. And with the more emergencies that may arise, the employee level becomes less and less experienced, hands-on experience. So that's a real danger that's showing up. I was also going to raise the issue of concrete. As I understand it, with these plants, concrete has been shown to get brittle after about 40 years, 30 to 40 years, and it becomes essentially dangerous to have a plant that doesn't have new concrete all over it. And the fact that the NRC has been giving 20-year licenses, just handing them out just like crazy, on plants that are already 30 and 40 years old means that they're totally irresponsible in the future, the future risk of these plants. So, yeah, if you have any knowledge of that.
You know, it's interesting. I was listening to Mighty House. It might have been yesterday, Dave, and Rich Cowgill said there are two types of concrete. There's fresh concrete and concrete that's cracked. And I think you're making that point, aren't you, Dave?
Well, but this is, if it becomes irradiated, it becomes brittle.
And his point was that it doesn't need to be irradiated to crack. But at any rate, I'll let Dave Kraft address this, Dave.
Well, I guess we'll start with the concrete issue. You're both right. I mean, the concrete, we have seen failures already all over this country in terms of the concrete that's been poured at the reactors for a variety of reasons. Crystal River reactor has an enormous crack going through its containment wall. We had a situation in Ohio at the Davis-Besse reactor where the utility is now claiming because of a severe blizzard that occurred in the 1970s, and forced water into the porosity of the concrete that lodged there, and it started this cracking going. There are lots of reasons why concrete crack, why it degrades. We're actually waiting for the verdict on the so-called, there's a reactor in Nebraska called Fort Calhoun, which we have renamed Port Calhoun because it was surrounded by the Missouri River in the floods last year. That reactor complex was essentially underwater for months at a time. We don't know what the effects of that are going to be on the underlying foundational concrete, not just the containment concrete. So this is always an issue at nuclear reactors. And as your caller pointed out, It does chemically get altered depending where it is in the plant and how close it is in proximity to the radiation fields, that it will degrade as well. Yep. The institutional memory part is really worrisome and never gets attention because, again, it's...
And Dave, that was a really great point that you brought up. It's something I hadn't thought about. I mean, I knew that people were being exposed to high levels of radiation, but it didn't occur to me that you lose those people, you lose that institutional memory.
And it's not just happening in Japan. It's happening all over the nuclear industry worldwide. We've experienced it in the United States, and we see it at the NRC itself, where I think some extraordinary number, 60% of their employees are new within the last 5 or so years. This is a huge drain of experience that's gone forever. And utilities, in an effort to save money, usually talk about early retirement packages for their institutional memory folks. You know, they hire new folks, which are cheaper, and get rid of the old memory. And the problem here in the United States is we don't have standardized reactors like they do in France, where, you know, the men's room on the fifth floor of this reactor can be found in the same place if you go 500 miles down the road.
We're into rugged individualism. Yeah,
exactly. So every plant is different. And when you lose the institutional memory here, the roadmap is burned to the ground. So it's a real serious situation.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. I remember reading an article probably about 5 years ago. Bush had done some budget cuts for the medical care for the people that worked at some of the top secret places, Hanford, Oak Ridge, whatnot. And so he had actually cut the budget for the employees there. He had cut their medical plan budget. And so, if you really think about it, these are people that work in top secret projects. It's against the law for them to disclose what they do. And they can't just go to a doctor, a new doctor, and tell them, oh, well, I've been working with beryllium. I've been working with some isotope. It's against the law for them to disclose to their doctor what they're doing. So they can't just go out there and buy a medical plan off the shelf. And it's important. They may be trapped with a company doctor, but they're essentially, when Bush did a budget cut for the top secret employees, he essentially sentenced them to death. And it's interesting because of the loss of institutional memory. Some of these people may have been dumb jerks, but for them to even lose their institutional memory in the stupid projects that they're working on becomes even a greater hazard. But and one last thing, the overproduction of electricity, it's my understanding that that almost every power plant in the country is overproducing electricity by about 150%. So if America needs, I'll just do a round number, 100 million megawatts an hour, they're producing 150 million megawatts an hour. And it's entirely wasteful. And the idea of going over to solar, to wind power, to all of these other alternative energies is denied us because the nuclear power plants, because they're so expensive, they have this... they have an automatic financing draw. So in other words, the electricity from the nuclear plant automatically gets paid to them. But people out here in California, if you have solar on your roof, you don't get paid in cash for selling electricity. You get a credit. And if you put 100% electricity or solar on your roof, you only get 100% credit. If you put 150% on your roof, you're only going to get 150% credit, but you'll never get cash. But the nuclear plants are always getting the cash, and so there is no incentive for alternative energy to be given an advancement. As I understand it, for example, in California, if you've got this 150% on your roof, you're only going to be able to keep your credits for about 3 years. And so you simply lose that credit rather than get the equivalent of cash. So there is no incentive, and that's been built into the financing of alternative energy.
I need to. I'm going to stop you right there because I'm going to have to let you go, and we're going to wrap this up. But I got a real quick tweet that someone doesn't understand, and if you could do it in like in 30 seconds, please clarify, nuclear workers can't tell their doctors what they've been exposed to. What's that all about, Dave?
Well, essentially, if you were, you know, you're a top secret worker working at the Hanford plant, which is...
Okay, it gets down to you, if you're working on classified projects, then you really can't divulge that.
Yeah, exactly. You can't say what radioactive isotopes, what chemicals, what anything you're using. You can't tell your doctor what you're using because you're essentially giving him top secret information.
Right. Okay, I get it. Dave, listen, your contribution's been great. I really appreciate it. You have a good Sunday. Dave, there's so much more we could talk about, but it's been a great conversation, and I really appreciate you taking the time. You to come down to, do you have any final words on this? Where are we headed, and how do we make the change?
Yeah, the change is off of nuclear and off of carbon and into a different, qualitatively different kind of energy system based on renewables. But it's also, we have to reduce our consumption. We have to use less. In fact, we could use less because we waste, if you believe the Electric Power Research Institute, almost twice the amount of electricity as all of the nuclear plants in this country produce. So when you got a leaky bucket, the solution is not to build a bigger pump, you know, and that's really what the United States is.
And as Dave, the caller, mentioned, you know, overproducing electricity. Well, if our grid weren't so ineffective.
That's the next thing. We not only need a new energy system, we need a new grid. And it's got to be a grid that's redundant, that is more resilient, that is more locally oriented, because that would certainly improve the reliability, and we wouldn't have to worry about brownouts, blackouts as much. And we wouldn't also have to worry about catering to the large power producers that have nuclear and coal plants.
Well, I'm happy to have you back in here, and we'll talk about this issue again.
And the one last thing I would say is if people have questions, you can email us at neis.org. And certainly visit our website at www.neis.org.
And, of course, if you can't write that down right now, all of that information is on my website, mikenovak.net. Go to this week's show. It's all there, some of the articles we're talking about. I've got the letter to the editor you wrote to the Trib, not quite the whole thing, but a lot of it, so people can take a look at it. So Dave Kraft from the Nuclear Energy Information Service, thank you so much.
And thanks for having
me. We will talk again soon.
All right, Mike, stay well.